This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Thursday, ratifying the RAT test. New South Wales COVID case numbers rise dramatically as rapid test results are included for the first time. And we speak to the founder of a startup company helping businesses keep their staff safe at work.
The responsibility to be able to sort of track and trace and understand who close contacts are within a workforce is now squarely on the business to try and manage and reduce their risks.
Let's crunch the numbers. And at first glance, the figures look alarming. New South Wales has recorded more than 90,000 new COVID cases today. Doing the maths, that's a jump of more than 60,000 from the previous day. But it is expected. Today is the first time that rapid antigen test results have been included in the tally. One epidemiologist has described the current COVID data in Australia as a mess. So how are experts keeping track of the pandemic? Isabel Rowe reports.
Every day for 2 years, many Australians have kept track of one number.
There were 7,442 new infections.
There were 20,030 cases detected.
23,100.
There were 34,759 cases of COVID.
Earlier on in the pandemic, the daily COVID case number gave health authorities a gauge on when to ramp up or wind back public health measures. But now, epidemiologists like Professor Adrian Esterman say the number is losing meaning.
Things are messy. It is extremely difficult to actually sort this out because of the introduction of rapid antigen test results.
Yesterday, New South Wales became the last state or territory to start counting rapid antigen tests along with PCR tests in its daily case tally. And it's blown out the statistics. More than 61,000 rapid tests have been logged, covering the first 12 days of 2022. The state has made it compulsory to report a positive test and have set a $1,000 fine for those who don't. Adrian Esterman says it will take a few days to make sense of the data.
The other thing we measure is the percentage of test results that turn out to be positive. And in most states and territories, we've been seeing very high percentages. Now, of course, now we've introduced rapid antigen test results, we can't calculate that because we know how many were positive, that is people who report them, but we've got no idea how many tests were taken.
So does that mean that there really isn't a way going forward to know the number of new cases each day, and does it matter?
Look, you can still do modelling. What we've seen is that the effective reproduction number, which tells us how well things are doing or not, has been slowly coming down in New South Wales. So I think the pattern's still going to be there, and we will see this outbreak coming to its maximum in the next few days.
Rapid antigen tests have been included in daily tallies in South Australia, Victoria and Queensland for some days now. And Professor Esterman is confident those states too should see a peak in infections in coming days. In the meantime, the sheer scale of the outbreak is still crippling supply chains. The Victorian Premier, Dan Andrews, has added more industries to the state's new isolation rules in an attempt to free up critical workers who are close contacts of positive cases.
Emergency services, education, critical utilities, custodial facilities, those sectors will join the food sector in a broad sense. They will be exempt if they're playing a critical role. They will be exempt from having to do home ISO. They will need to take a RAT test for 5 days. And if that is negative, then they can proceed to do that critical work that we need them to do.
As for who should be responsible for finding and providing rapid tests for critical workers, Dan Andrews has this response.
It is the employer. The employee cannot be asked to provide their own test. That would not be, I think, fair.
But he says as for where businesses can get those rapid tests, it's not up to government.
It won't be for us to provide those to businesses as of right.
New South Wales Customer Service Minister Victor Dominello has also admitted rapid tests are incredibly difficult to come by, but insists that will change.
There's a large shipment coming of about 50 million. I accept that criticism. And again, those procurement issues are being resolved.
The federal government this week placed 5 tenders on its website seeking urgent supply of rapid tests. The opposition says the recent purchases show the government wasn't prepared for the latest COVID outbreak.
That's Isabel Rowe reporting there. Well, 2 years into the pandemic, aged care providers and advocates have slammed the federal government for what they say is a gross failure to prepare for the Omicron outbreak. Thousands of residents have been infected with COVID, and aged care workers are either off sick or isolating amid claims the system is in crisis. The federal government says it sent millions of rapid antigen tests to aged care homes, but many haven't arrived. Rhett Burney reports.
When COVID first hit Australia's aged care homes, families of residents could only despair as their loved ones were locked in their rooms. At its worst, some were left without care and many became ill with the virus, which has now killed over 1,000 aged care residents. Three more died in Queensland overnight. 2 years into the pandemic, outbreaks are surging, and advocates like Dr. Sarah Russell say lessons from the past still haven't been learnt.
The Royal Commission did a three-day pandemic hearing after the Victorian outbreak. They concluded that the federal government did not prepare the aged care sector for the pandemic. Now, this lack of preparedness is evident throughout the whole of the last 2 years.
The Director of Aged Care Matters is among a growing number of advocates and providers who say the system is at breaking point.
The system was in complete crisis before the pandemic. We've had a Royal Commission to try to address some of the systemic problems in the aged care sector, but we haven't addressed them.
Among the issues, she says, is a critical shortage of staff, made even worse by the Omicron wave, which has seen thousands of residents infected with the virus and workers either off sick themselves or isolating as close contacts. Paul Sadler is the CEO of Aged and Community Services Australia. He made this dire prediction on RN Breakfast this morning.
We reckon it's going to be over 1,000 aged care homes across the country by tomorrow that will be reporting outbreaks. And we believe that anywhere between 5 and 50% of the staff of aged care homes have been forced to be off work due to either contracting COVID or being close contacts.
Paul Sadler says residents are in danger of neglect.
It is true that people in aged care are missing essential care because there simply aren't enough staff to provide the care. This is urgent. We are calling on the federal government to take urgent action.
Both Paul Sadler and Sarah Russell say homes need more rapid antigen tests to be supplied by the federal government so staff can get back to caring for residents sooner. The aged care minister, Greg Hunt, declined our request for an interview, but in an earlier statement, his office said 5.6 million rapid testing kits have been deployed to homes from the national medical stockpile. But Mr. Sadler says this is yet to be seen.
Rapid antigen tests are not turning up. We were talking with Minister Colbeck about this and the Department of Health yesterday afternoon. They know that. They concede that to us. They concede that the major problem's been the interruption of supply chains.
So, sorry, they're acknowledging this to you, but they're telling us something entirely different.
That must be the case.
Sarah Russell also disputes the federal government's claim that it sent millions of tests.
I refer the Minister for Aged Care to the weekly data that is produced by the Department of Health. That states very clearly that 668 aged care homes had received a rapid antigen test by last Friday. There are 2,700 federally operated aged care homes.
Sarah Russell says reports in several newspapers today that hundreds of aged care homes at the centre of current outbreaks haven't had an infection control spot check in 6 months by the aged care regulator are also concerning.
It is an abrogation of duty, in my view, of the regulator not to check on both the staffing levels and the infection control protocols in the aged care homes that have had numerous outbreaks.
That's Director of Aged Care Matters there, Dr. Sarah Russell, and that report from Rhett Burney. Well, if you've got some rapid antigen tests in the cupboard, you are lucky. As we've been hearing for weeks, they are almost impossible to get around the country. But as doctors struggle with demands on their time, a busy Sydney GP is urging people not to take a negative result as a guarantee of being COVID-free. Samantha Donovan has more.
For Sydney GP Ken McCrory, it's another day of working flat out.
We're going to try and start our paediatric vaccination program. We've got our adults coming in for their boosters today. And we've got this new and increasing burden of trying to manage all the phone calls and patients with COVID being either unwell, low symptoms, and those that are casual or close contacts, with all the confusion about what to do, how to get my testing done, what does this test mean, what are the new rules today, which are probably going to be different by the time this goes to air.
What are the reasons for that surge in calls?
We've got our Prime Minister now encouraging people that anyone who tests positive call your GP, which is fine if we had the resources to deal with it.
So what's your message then to government?
With our leadership in government, you know, we've got this new triple whammy, kids, adults and the disease, and we're not resourced to deal with this. I can't do all three things at the same time. You know, I can't be in the middle of vaccinating a five-year-old and get phone calls from a patient like this week. Oh, I can't breathe. What do I do? Or my wife with cancer, she's sick. With her COVID, she's getting worse. What do I do? I can't physically answer those calls whilst we're doing the vaccines or when we're trying to organise the booster program. I need funding to use my practice nurses to be able to do that, which they're not able to do now. That's on top of this massive health deficit we're still seeing. You know, I'm still getting people with heart disease, with diabetes, with their asthma exacerbations, with new cancers coming in every day because that's job. But there's a big deficit now in they're not getting time to get their health issues under control either because I'm taken away from that.
The Victorian chair of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Dr. Anita Munoz, shares her colleagues' concerns.
I certainly think that the call to call general practice in the event of a positive test has put a really undue pressure on our sector, and I think it's really important for general practice to receive notification that pandemic policies are going to change before announcements are made so we can prepare ourselves for those changes.
Dr. Ken McCrory is also concerned people are relying on rapid antigen test results too much. He thinks when people have symptoms, 10 to 30% of RAT results may be false negatives.
So the amount of people that have been running around, walking around, going to parties, Christmas, New Year, who have the disease, doing what they're being told is the right thing because they've got a negative rapid antigen test and spreading it has just been, it's been crazy. We need to get the message to people that needing to still be distancing yourself socially, to still be wearing your mask, to still be, you know, sanitising as much as before, unnecessarily catching up, particularly with people who are vulnerable, you know, those that are elderly, those with chronic health diseases, those with immunosuppression. They're still at high risk, even if they've had two, three, or shortly we'll be having a fourth injection for the most severely immunocompromised.
Infectious diseases expert at the University of Queensland, Associate Professor Paul Griffin, is also urging people not to take a negative result as a complete all clear.
So to be approved, the rapid antigen tests need a sensitivity of over 80%, which means that up to one-fifth of those tests could actually be false negatives. But then having said that, there are actually varying grades of tests that have been approved. There are those that have been deemed adequate, which have a sensitivity of 80 to 90%, those that have been deemed high, which is 90 to 95%, and those that have a very high sensitivity, which is over 95%. So, in fact, if you use one of those types of tests, then your chance of getting a false negative is actually quite low, down in that vicinity of 5% or less. So, of course, at the moment, we don't really have the luxury of being able to choose. It's a question of getting whichever one you can.
That's Associate Professor Paul Griffin from the University of Queensland there. Samantha Donovan reporting. On ABC Radio, right across the country, you're listening to The World Today. Well, as COVID cases rise rapidly, startups are developing technology to help businesses keep staff at work. Before the pandemic began, Brendan White and his business partner were running a tech company for the conference and event industry in Melbourne. But as the city shut down, they had to make a rapid change. They decided to develop software for businesses trying to keep employees and customers safe during the pandemic. Brendan White is Chief Operating Officer of Comply Group.
That's right. Yeah, we did. We had to shut one business down, and then we actually were able to turn this technology on and get it ready within about 7 days.
How much more pressure is on business now to take care of some of these issues of compliance around COVID?
I think the responsibility to be able to sort of track and trace and understand who close contacts are within a workforce is now sort of squarely on the business to try and manage and reduce their risks. Sort of the QR code at the door is one thing, but there was always a need to be able to try and understand what was happening within your workplace and within tight spaces.
So now companies, in a way, are having to do their own track and tracing in a miniature sense to keep a sense of what's going on.
Yeah, it's starting to do that. There's a line, there's a fine balance that everyone needs to kind of play to help employees not feel like there's too much oversight, but also be able to understand where the sort of the high risk areas are and make sure that you know who's coming in and out of those spaces. It's one thing to be able to sort of tell the boss your vaccine status, but then it's a different thing to be able to sort of upload it to a third party that's sort of a trusted health information sort of collection service. It's a fine balance, and there's definitely a lot of complexity to it.
What's the biggest business lesson that this whole exercise has taught you, Brendan?
I think it's be flexible and don't assume you know what's going to happen tomorrow. We've seen the change in the last couple of months where suddenly the pressure moves from different teams and different areas of the business to try and manage different risks. And then people just kind of have to roll with it.
And what about in the development of these technologies? What have you learned?
It's that we see a news a press release come out from a government department mandating a new change to a specific rule in a specific industry, and we just need to be able to have something that's flexible enough to be able to cater for that. So it's really a matter of just building things as flexibly as possible so that you're able to help the business owners really understand what they need to do, no matter what the rule is that comes out.
When you've been working across multiple states, have you lost count of the number of compliance rule changes there've been in the past couple of years?
So especially when we're focused on building our product, then we see a new rule come out. we're sometimes surprised. But what the complexity is when the rules start stacking. So you've got kind of a rule for healthcare a rule for a different industry that needs to have something, and then there might be an overlap between those. So it's up to people to really understand them, and it's sometimes quite challenging.
Brendan, you're based in Western Australia at the moment, where COVID numbers are lowest by far in the country. What's the difference like between what you see in your daily personal life compared to what you're dealing with in a business sense with the eastern states in particular?
Yeah, it's a vast difference. So I spend most of my life on Zoom mentally in New South Wales, Queensland and Victoria at the moment, and then walk outside into sunny Perth. But there, it's a strange place to be at the moment. A lot of people that I talk to over here are watching the news and expecting similar things soon.
A month or two ago, did it feel like the pandemic and this opportunity was slowing down?
I think from my point of view, it was probably the same as most other people. We thought things were calming down a bit. And then, as of recently, things have changed very quickly.
That's Brendan White, Chief Operating Officer of tech startup Comply Group. Well, as the supply chain crisis intensifies, some farmers are walking away from millions of dollars worth of produce. Livestock, too, are becoming overweight and difficult to manage and market. Economists say while pandemic disruptions are well beyond the control of most farmers, some may not have planned well enough for significant staff shortages. Dale Drinkwater has more.
Emma Germano is a third-generation farmer in Victoria. She grows cauliflower and sells it to a pretty big supermarket chain. And while her produce has made it to the supermarket aisles, as the president of the Victorian Farmers Federation, she knows many farmers who've struggled to do the same.
We are already seeing some farmers who are talking about, you know, they're ploughing in already, you know, up to 30%, 40% of their crops. I know of one grower who has a hothouse facility or a glasshouse facility that grows both tomatoes and cucumbers that just last week alone they had to walk away from nearly $1 million worth of produce, and they are anticipating that that's going to continue week on week for the next few weeks at the very least.
The chains of supply have seen widespread choke points as staff shortages from the Omicron outbreak bring processing to a halt. With long lead-in times, primary producers have been growing the same amount of food, but they don't have the labour to pick it. Food processors and logistics have lost staff to sickness, so meat and vegetables haven't been making it to the supermarket shelves. Now farmers are trying to grapple with what to do with perishable goods, which just keep growing.
For example, a pig can put on a kilo of meat per day. So if we've got to hold those animals on farm for up to a fortnight, they're now 15 kilos overweight that would normally be accepted by the market. And the meat itself starts getting too big, so the particular cuts start getting too big, and then the way that the supply chain has the capacity to process a bigger animal actually changes. So those animals need to leave the production system because there's new ones coming in, of course, and it can lead to animal welfare issues. The last thing anybody wants to see is animals being dispatched that ultimately don't become food for human consumption.
She says the financial costs are huge and could change who does and doesn't farm in Australia.
You know, we don't plant today and then pick tomorrow, and that's what the major concern is, because we can't just undermine that resilience of our Australian farms waiting for the supply chain to get back in action. This actually has the potential of changing who the farmers around the country are, because if you are highly leveraged with the bank, you don't have enough money to keep yourself sustained for an extended period of time, we could potentially see farmers going out of business.
Economists argue some of the issues currently facing food producers and farmers could have been avoided. Agricultural economist Chris Wright says the industry hasn't planned well enough for significant workforce shortages.
While the current challenges are to some extent beyond their control, they certainly could have planned better for such a scenario in the past decade or so.
He sees no let up to the current crisis.
There is still a cohort of farmers out there who are relying upon the short-term solutions that haven't really been very effective at addressing systematic workforce need. At the moment, it's pretty hard to see a way out of the current situation with people having to leave their jobs in the supply chain because of infection or come into close contact with COVID cases. So I think at the moment, it's pretty hard to see what the way out of this might be. But I think there are some solutions out there that could be embraced more wholeheartedly across the sector.
One dairy farmer from Kyogle in northern New South Wales, Shane Hickey, has wholeheartedly embraced his own systematic change.
We diversified about 12, 18 months ago into value-adding our own products, and we do home deliveries directly to our customers. So we cut off those major supply chain issues that they're having at the present time, and we're not having those issues because we're not being controlled by the two major supermarkets. And in the process, we pack our products, we value-add it, and we drive directly to our customers and drop it off. So much better.
That's dairy farmer there, Shane Hickey, ending that report from Dale Drinkwater. Finally today, a leading climate change scientist says a proposed gas project in Queensland's Channel Country could increase Australia's emissions by up to 60%. The International Energy Agency says there should be no new oil and gas projects if countries want to reach zero emissions. But in Queensland, fossil fuel projects continue to expand. Nathan Morris reports.
Over 1,200 kilometres west of Brisbane, Queensland's Channel Country is a vast floodplain where a web of waterways drains into the Lake Eyre Basin. It's renowned grazing country, but below the Mitchell Grass Downs, there's also a huge reserve of shale gas. And resources companies have been slowly progressing plans to develop the region.
There's been discussion about possibly fracking in the Channel Country in southwest Queensland and northeast South Australia.
That's Emeritus Professor Ian Lowe, a leading climate change scientist from Griffith University. Environmental group Lock the Gate commissioned him to model potential emissions from the proposed gas development in Queensland's Channel Country.
What startled me was the scale of impact. The basic conclusion is that even a modest level of production would be incompatible with Queensland's stated emission reduction targets, and the higher level of production would amount to something like 60% of Australia's current total emissions.
Despite this, a Queensland government spokesperson says its emissions targets are achievable.
Queensland achieved 20% of its renewable energy target by 2020 and is almost halfway to reaching its 2030 emissions reduction target.
Professor Lowe also found that the Lake Eyre Basin contained high levels of additional CO2, which would be released directly into the atmosphere during gas extraction. The other factor was the fugitive emissions from gas production. These are emissions from the methane gas that unavoidably escapes during the extraction process.
And methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And so the leakage, if gas were produced in the Channel Country, would add significantly to our greenhouse gas production locally.
Queensland has the highest fugitive emissions in the nation, and they continue to rise. After gas prices fell during 2020, international demand has rebounded, and the International Energy Agency forecasts more growth in the coming years.
All these gas companies at the moment are trying to produce as much gas and ship as much gas as they possibly can.
That's Bruce Robertson, an energy finance analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
If it's not contracted gas, they're making enormous money on it.
While demand for gas remains strong now, he thinks that that will change.
And the change is very rapid when it occurs. And all the factors are in place for that change to occur in gas. In New South Wales, for example, the state where I live, there are 17 battery projects, grid-scale battery projects in the planning system right now.
That's Bruce Robertson ending that report from Nathan Morris. And that's all from the World Today team. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.